Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and you are in tune for another edition for The Road Report. Thank you for joining us this morning as I attempt to make my way to my job on the mean streets of the 401 Express and Collectors Highway in Toronto, as I mentioned before in the intro. So keep in mind that for these road reports that I do, they're quick little episodes where I, you know, kind of do a stream of consciousness. I don't have any ability to fact check myself, check my phone or my iPad, or at least I shouldn't. And as I speak to you and go over whatever topic we're talking about, I'll probably get a couple of things wrong. So pardon me and I'm sorry. But in the meanwhile, let's have a good time talking about some comics and stuff that I've recently read or movies that I've watched. And for today, we are going to head back into the X-Men universe. As I was mentioning on our last road report, I'm kind of doing a deep dive into the X-Men universe. As I started off reading Deadpool and Cable, it made me want to go back and rediscover, I guess you could say is the right word, some of the X-Men stories that I know I would like, but I have always kind of shied away from because it just seemed like too much of a deep dive and not sure where to start, where to end, what to collect, where to collect it, because it can be a little bit difficult and expensive to do so. How this all happened was, well, like I said, I was reading Deadpool and Cable, and I didn't know much about the Cable character, and I was enjoying what I had been reading about him. And he is, again, a very 90s character, and there's a bit of a complexity to the history of Nathan Summers. So I did a YouTube rabbit hole kind of thing where I went back and just looked up who Cable was. And as it's being explained to me on one of those YouTube videos, complete with panels from comic books being shown and little bits of history here and there, I realized that there's quite a bit of depth to the history of this character. And it made me feel nostalgic about all of those comics that they were showing, stuff that I was kind of familiar with, had heard about before, but had never really full out read. Some of the stuff I had read, because they went all the way back to, you know, the Dark Phoenix saga, making references to that. And then you hear about Madeline Pryor, who became the clone of Jean Grey, and all of this stuff. And I'm just seeing all of these snapshots of comic books from that era that look like a lot of fun to read. It's making me feel of make it reminding me of the X-Men animated series. So I went to my collection, saw which books I had that I could read, which ones I didn't. So Amazon was being searched quite fervently. And then I put in an order for a few books that I did not own that were actually on sale for pretty decent prices for brand new books. So I purchased a couple of those. And I'm buying them backwards. I'm kind of reverse engineering this whole thing, and I'm not reading things in order, but that's okay. I'm reading for the fun of it. Also, what kind of inspired this deep dive, I have to give a shout out, of course, to my fellow podcasters. But in this case, again, it was the Comic Shenanigans, Adam Chapman. I was going through one of my podcast downloading queue, seeing what I hadn't read, listened to before while I'm at work, and I listened to his episode about X-Men number 25, which is famously or infamously the issue where, or the one of the final issues of Fatal Attractions, which is ultimately what I'm trying to read here, is Fatal Attractions, because I've had this hardcover copy of it sitting on my shelf for years that completely collects the entire event. That is pretty well respected and remembered. Very 90s, of course, but that's okay because I'm a kid of the 90s. And I want to get to this point of X-Men 25 where there's this very, very famous showdown between Magneto and Wolverine that kind of sent shockwaves through comic book readers back when this had been released, because basically what had happened was Wolverine facing off against Magneto. What is Magneto known for? Well, his ability to manipulate and the magnetic force of the Earth, and in that case, metal. And we all know that Wolverine is, his skeleton is coated in adamantium. It's an adamantium coated skeleton, and Magneto, spoilers, pulls out all of the metal out of Wolverine's body in a torturous, horrendous way that was drawn by Andy Kubert and is still talked about to this day. And I've never read this story, but I know it well enough to the point where why do I even have to read it? But I do want to get to it and experience the culmination of this Fatal Attractions moment that took place in X-Men history. But to do that, me being a nutcase, I kind of want to, you know, do my due diligence in X-Men lore. And I went back and bought a bunch of books from that era or prior to that era. Because at the end of the day, I love X-Men as much as I love much of the other Marvel Universe characters and teams that I often talk about. But you do have to be sometimes in the right place in the right time. And it seems like right now, like I've said before, there's a lot of things happening in the X-Men universe that is making you feel that sense of nostalgia and wanting to go back and rediscover the stories through a different, I guess, a rear view lens to kind of see how it's all going to tie into whatever is happening in the modern day X-Men, because everything is being referenced now. Everything is being paid tribute to in some capacity, and definitely in a way that is changing the experience or the memory that you might have of these storylines initially. So it'll be fun. But the first one that I read, strangely enough, was the issue, the trade paperback collecting issues 281 to 293, The Bishop's Crossing, which was drawn by Wils Portacio. And the reason why I bring him up first is because during this era, it was clear that it was definitely being artist driven. These books were you know, the vehicles for the artist, because at this time, when you read the credits of these issues, whether it was in the X-Men, the adjectiveless X-Men, which was being drawn by Jim Lee, which was, you know, some of the best work of his career, and X-Men number one was famously known to be the highest selling comic book of all time. And it was, the good thing about it was a quality work. It was the swan song of Chris Claremont, who had worked in the X-Men universe and the Uncanny X-Men title for 15 years. And it goes without saying that his contribution to the X-Men universe is unmatched. I don't think it will ever be matched, to be quite honest. Everything we know and love about the X-Men, if you've watched an X-Men movie, maybe the original X-Men movies, but even some of the recent ones, a lot of what you see, a lot of what you may like, is born out of the run of Chris Claremont and his collaborators, which he had some fantastic collaborators during that time, and Jim Lee happened to be one of them. So getting back to Wils Portacio, during this time, when you read the credits of these books, the artists are often listed first as being the plotter and artists, and then there was a scripter who was, you know, just putting the words in the word bubbles here. They weren't as much in control of the storytelling elements during this time. And I have to say, while I'm reading these books, you definitely feel like you are a kid again, and you can hear the X-Men theme music playing anytime you begin a new issue during this reading experience. So during Bishop's Crossing, which again takes place in that sweet spot of Uncanny X-Men 281 to 293, while I think we are in the beginning stages of the adjectiveless X-Men, which Jim Lee is at the helm of, you've got this story introducing this character named Bishop. That's why it's in the title, Bishop's Crossing. And Bishop is a time-displaced character from the not-so-distant future. He's not quite like Cable in that sense. He's from the not-so-distant future where the X-Men are revered and beloved. He's part of a police force, or a mutant police force. He's a mutant himself, but they're policing themselves in this future, known as the XSC. And what brings him to the modern day that the X-Men are existing in, which in this case is, I think, 1990, 1991, or perhaps 92. I don't remember the cover dates on these books. But what brings him to this time is that there's an escaped convict from the future, a character's name is Fitzroy, but I'm trying to describe him. I think he's from a well-to-do family, and he is just that sort of anarchist kid who is a heinous criminal, comes back to the modern day time that you're reading the book in, and causes a ruckus. He's in competition with, I think, one of the sons of Sebastian Shaw, if I'm not mistaken, and there's a overrunning of the Hellfire Club, which is where the books begin, and there's a big brouhaha at the Hellfire Club with the X-Men and this Fitzroy character, and it's presumed that Jean Grey seems to have died, which she doesn't. That's already been done before, and she won't be dying for another couple of years in this timeline. So this big, huge brouhaha, Fitzroy causes a ruckus. All of these other convicts from his era are also in the modern time that the X-Men are existing. So Bishop, from the future, comes back, who will use lethal force if he must with his two partners to collect or kill all of these criminals and bring them back to his time. And what's fun about this book is I love time displacement stories or characters from a different time, because I love seeing the reaction that they have anytime they come into a different era, or especially one where they feel that they know something about, and how will it affect their concept of all of these characters that they know and love when they go back to their time, if they ever do go back to their time. And I don't think Bishop, as far as I know, he doesn't go back to his time for quite a while, if he ever does, period. He stays with the X-Men after this story. So in this storyline, he comes to collect Fitzroy, but when he does encounter the X-Men, he doesn't really believe that it's them at first. He's ready to fight them. And that interaction is very interesting when he does have that realization that these are in fact the X-Men. Not everything that you think you know about them is exactly the way it is. It kind of makes you think about history in those terms, all of the things that you look back on in history that you love and admire and may be inspired by might not always be exactly as it is, but he still, Bishop that is, has a lot of reverence for these characters. And seeing him interact with each of them in their own way is very interesting, because some of the things that he might understand in his future, for instance, the character of Gambit and who he is and what he ends up, the type of person he ends up being possibly in the future, is brought into question. And the reaction that Bishop has with Gambit is quite interesting, because at this time, the character of Gambit is not, you don't really know too much about him. There's a shroud of mystery around this character. So seeing Bishop come back and have his dialogue with all of these characters and individual levels, but also seeing him adapt to this time, being a character who's known to use lethal force in the future, now when he's administering his level of justice, what seems to be justice to him, he's getting that rude awakening as well to, you know, this is not how things work in this time. So along with the Bishop storyline, you have things happening with the X-Men that are on this team, who I think the team now has been split in two sort of different factions. Not so much factions, but two tiers of teams, where you've got Cyclops, Wolverine, I don't remember all of the characters in the X-Men book. And then in the Uncanny X-Men book, you had Jean Grey, led by Storm, Bobby Drake, Colossus, as well as Warren Worthington, who was the Archangel at this time. So the teams are kind of split into those two mini factions. And this particular team goes on within these 12 issues. What's incredible about it, and I don't want to get into every story beat, because if you do end up wanting to read it, you don't want everything spoiled for you, because it isn't just a story simply about Bishop. He's included in these stories. This is his first introduction into the X-Men universe, and he's a part of these stories, but it's not all centered around him. I just gave you kind of the synopsis of what brought him into this timeline. But while you're reading these 12 issues or 13 issues of Uncanny X-Men, which is about a year's worth of comic book continuity, you get to see a lot of places that the X-Men go to. So many things are happening in their universe. Some plot lines aren't all necessarily picked up, but what was cool about comics at this time was that there were plot threads that were planted and picked up way later down the road. And you go back and reference to see where they have the precedent to sometimes take a story where they end up going with it, maybe years down the line, and you go back to these stories, and it gives them that sort of, what's the word I'm looking for here? There's the precedent, but also it makes these stories have that lasting power. Like, these still count, even though we're 4 years down the road. We're going back now to talk about that moment where you see a flashback in Cable's, Bishop's memory, where he sees the, you know, when they tapped into his mind to kind of see where he's from, to see who he is, he has this message or this video in his archived in his mind of what had happened to the X-Men in the future. What were their last moments? What was the message that he had archived in his brain from Jean Grey? So all of these things kind of come back later on. But while you're reading these stories, in the meanwhile, you're fully engaged in them because they're traveling to alternate dimensions where Colossus is now reintroduced to his brother Mikhail, and what happens in this alternate dimension is quite significant. And in this short period of time, when Colossus's brother comes back into the world that he's from, because he was lost in another dimension because he was a cosmonaut from Russia and he had gone missing for years. Everybody thought he was dead, but he had in fact been living. What part will he play when he comes back to the modern world that he's from? And this is the beginning of the breakdown of Colossus as a character, where he's going to suffer quite a shock to the system and losses in his life. So there's a lot of moving pieces in these storylines during this era of X-Men. A lot of story to unpack here. And I enjoyed it quite a bit, even though I knew nothing about it, which I knew things about it, I shouldn't say that, but this is my first time reading it, my first time really engaging with Will Sportacio's artwork, which I did enjoy very much. And I will say, as I'm reading this collection of books, there are a few times where the artwork changes. There's an issue where John Romita fills in, John Romita Jr., that is, and then at the end of this story or this collection, you have Tom Rainey putting in some work. And what I will say is that this is one of those times where I see the difference that an inker makes with an artist's work and how you engage with it once it's all put together on a page. There's one issue in this collection that is inked by Bill Sienkiewicz, who is a legendary titan in the comic book industry, the comic book world, as an artist, painter, all of that stuff. But when it comes to him being an inker, I gotta say I'm not a big fan of it, simply because I feel it becomes much more his art as opposed to the penciler, who you're kind of getting used to either reading or engaging with. And when he puts his inks, they're so heavy, they're so thick. And this is something that I experienced when I was reading the Clone Saga collections, where he started to ink Sal Buscema's work, which I enjoyed it because he was the consistent inker on all of Sal Buscema's work in those books, which I didn't mind. I kind of became accustomed to, but in this one, it's very jarring. And that was the moment in the book where it wasn't that the art was bad, but I didn't enjoy it as much. I felt like I would have preferred Scott Williams or I'm not sure who the other inkers were. I gotta look through my book, but I remember there was one issue where Scott Williams was the inker, and it was very refreshing, and it kind of made me appreciate Scott Williams a whole lot more in regards to Jim Lee's artwork, because Scott Williams is famously known for being Jim Lee's regular inker, and you can now see what he brings to the table as far as the sharpness and the line work and the ability to have this sort of high definition version of these artists who have this particular style, which, you know, is definitely a product of the 90s, but it was so beautiful to look at. And when you look at Will Sportacio's pencils with Alex Sinclair, he's the colorist, Scott Williams' inks, I enjoyed it much more in the reading adventure that I went through in this book. So all in all, I enjoy this book quite a bit. I would recommend it to anybody who wants to get into X-Men lore. it's worthwhile to have it as part of the reading engagement that you're going to go on if you're doing what I'm doing. It can be a little bit pricey, but you do get a lot of bang for your buck. This trade Canadian cover price, I think, is $45, which is a lot of money. But if you do look around, if you do look on Amazon or go to your comic book shop that has, you know, some sort of membership discount, it is worth it because you do get a lot of comics in the collection. There's over 14 issues, 340 pages, some bonus material as well. And they're not a 5-minute read, which is the cool part of this era. These books take their time, and there's a lot of things that are introduced here that count. That's the word I was looking for before. There's these issues, they're made to count later on. As 90s and as bombastic and silly as it is, if you enjoyed the X-Men animated series at any point in your life, this is a great era to get into because you definitely feel like you're part of it. In this collection, you've got everything from characters from the future. Morlocks are brought into this story in a pretty impactful and important way. I'm trying to think of what else. There's that moment in X-Men number 8, which is included in the middle of this collection, that has those soft moments, those quiet moments with the team where they're all engaging on one of those moments of a quiet day at the X-Mansion with each other, building up their relationship and personal dynamics between each other. That I love seeing in the X-Men, as well as the relationship between Storm and Forge. This is a key moment in their relationship as well, and how things move forward in that regard. Another highlight for me, not in necessarily a positive way, but in a way to kind of realize how important the X-Men are in the comic book universe. And I know I use that term quite loosely, or I say it so often that it seems like it doesn't mean much, but the X-Men have always been that book that makes you really think about your interaction with humanity. It makes you really think about your interaction with ideas and your way of thinking. And this collection does that in a number of ways. One of them is Bobby Drake, Iceman, who is going to he goes on a date with his girlfriend at the time, Opal, and she's a Asian American. I don't know if she's American, but she's Asian, and they're an interracial couple. But his father, who's Bobby Drake's father, who's the father of a mutant, which in and of itself should help him to have a little bit more of a progressive way of thinking or an appreciation for those who aren't necessarily like him, he has a real problem with his son, who is, okay, there's one thing that he's a mutant, but now he's got to do this interracial dating and corrupt our family line. Like, those are issues that are addressed in these comic books. And as much as they're done in a way that was meant for young readers to ingest, it's also things that you're thinking about, like, these are topics worth talking about. These are things that at a time, and if kids of the 90s were reading these books, you can kind of see where a lot of the progressive ideas of today might be coming from. If a lot of these kids, this was their form of entertainment at that time. And some of these things were also brought into the animated series. And during that time of the 90s, I feel like everybody in some capacity was affected by those superhero animated series, whether it was Spider-Man, X-Men, Batman, whatever the case may be. So it was fun to go back and read these stories that I feel still have their finger on the pulse in some areas of modern day comics. There's definitely things that have changed, definitely things that are different, which is, you know, good. Things like that, there should be change, there should be difference. And when you go back to read comics of an era, I'm not going back to the Bronze Age, to the you know, the 80s or the 90s, hoping to read a comic that was released yesterday on the shelf. I want to feel like I'm back in that time, and these books, or this collection, definitely does that. I'm going to be reverse engineering, as I said. I'm going to be reading all over the map with the X-Men collections that I have on my shelf that I haven't dug into yet, and as I read them, I'm going to try to do a road report on those issues. So that is my my blabber about Bishop's Crossing, the first of the bunch of X-Men collections that I'm going to be reading. Don't forget to check us out on iTunes. Leave us a review there. It always helps to get the show out there. email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you again, everybody, for listening and hearing me ramble on this morning. I hope you have a great day, and come back soon for more episodes from the Cave of Solitude. Talk to you later.